this evening. My brother dropped off his wife at a hairstylist, and she was supposed to call me when she was ready to be picked up. She must have dialed the wrong number, she reported later. She called and a man answered and said, "Hello," to which she cheerfully said, "Come and get me." The man said, "Are you sure, ma'am? This is Mitchell's funeral home." That kind of shake you up, wouldn't it? Checking out of the grocery store, I noticed that a bag boy was eyeing my two adopted children. They often draw scrutiny since my son is a blonde Russian, while my daughter is a shiny black Haitian. The boy continued staring as he carried our groceries to the car. You can tell this has been a while. I don't think anybody does that anymore. But anyway, finally he asked, "Are those your kids?" "Yes, they are," I answered proudly. "They adopted?" he said. "Yes," I replied. His response, "I thought so," he concluded. "I figured you were too old to have small kids." So it wasn't quite what she anticipated. Chapter 19 of Matthew. Just to quickly review where we were last time, the first number of verses deal with a question that was brought to Jesus about the legitimacy of divorce. What grounds are legitimate? We talked about the two schools of thought among the rabbis. One school of thought was you could divorce for any reasons you saw fit. The requirement was to give a writ of divorce and then send her away. And that was understood to give her the freedom to remarry. The other school of thought said, no, you can't just divorce for any reason at all. It must be a very significant one. It doesn't require divorce, but it will allow a divorce when there is infidelity. Or the word is porneia. It's an umbrella term that means a lot of different kind of things. It would be under that particular kind of terminology. Why were they approaching Jesus with this? It could very well be that it was another one of their clever traps, or they thought it would be. Because if you remember, John the Baptist was beheaded because of challenging Herod's marriage and the legitimacy of his marriage to his brother's Philip's wife. You remember that? Mm-hmm. It could very well be that that's what they were trying to do. They were trying to get Jesus into a commitment that one way or another would get the attention of Herod. And perhaps the same fate would wait Jesus as well that John the Baptist experienced. Don't know for sure, but it seems to imply that. Now, once he finishes talking about marriage, it's interesting. They're asking about divorce, but Jesus answers about marriage. This is a good rule of thumb for us too, because you can be asked a question that can actually put you into a position that's a very thorny kind of issue. The proverbial the rock in a hard place. So what Jesus does here is they're asking about divorce, but what Jesus does is he goes to marriage. What marriage is supposed to be. What God designed it to be. And in so doing, he diffuses the issue. He diffuses the debate. We can do the same kind of thing. We live in a day of moral uncertainty in the lives of so many. And we might be asked, what's your view of gay marriage? And they may be painting a trap for you to call you a bigot and call you hard-hearted. You're unloving. You're blah, 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 whatever else they throw along with it. And you can deal with that if you want. And maybe at times it's good to deal with that issue head on. However, if someone is asking you a question about marriage, you can do the same thing that Jesus did. You don't have to deal with the aberration of what marriage is supposed to be. Go to what God designed it to be. That's what we need to be doing anyway. It's similar. Go back to the root instead of just dealing with the expression of whatever it might be. You can do this in a lot of different areas. Jesus did it a lot. Well, I say a lot. He did it many times when they thought they had a gotcha question, and they tried. The Sadducees are going to try it with a gotcha question about the woman married to 7 different brothers. In the resurrection, because they don't believe in a resurrection, whose wife is she going to be? Which of the 7? The first one, the last one, the middle one? When? And Jesus simply points out, you don't understand the Bible. You don't understand God's word, do you? And then he goes back and he deals with it. And so that's kind of something you and I can think we can learn from. Because a lot of times, I don't know if you have this tendency, but if somebody asks a question about something like that, especially if they're antagonistic, you want to just, pull out your apologetic backpack and just nail them with it. When that might not be the best approach. It really might not be. The better approach, you're talking about divorce, but you need to understand something. Let's go back to God's design. It's a lot better way of approaching it, and it's very effective. Matter of fact, it was so effective that it freaked out his disciples. You can imagine this. Look at verse 10. His disciples said to him, "If such is the case of a man with his wife, it's better not to marry." Hey, if you're locked in like that, maybe you ought to forego marriage. Well, that's not what Jesus is meaning, and Jesus' response to that is very telling. He goes on and he says, "But he said to them, 'All cannot accept this saying, but only those to whom it has been given. For are those that are eunuchs who were born thus from their mother's womb, and there are those who were made that way by men, and there are those who have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He who is able to accept it, accept it. Let him accept it." Okay? All right. So the question, they say, well, it's better not to marry then. Well, is it? Is it really better not? And Jesus is saying, no, you're missing the point. There are some people that won't marry for various reasons. And he cites 3 of those reasons. However, he doesn't make a blanket statement that people should not marry. That's a mistake that the Roman Catholic Church has made with nuns and priests. And they have been paying for it ever since by requiring some to take a vow of celibacy. Well, if you've been given, as Jesus says, the gift of celibacy, that's one thing. But to try to live that way, if you haven't been received that gift, you can be in a much more precarious situation. And if you don't have to look very far into Roman Catholic history to find popes with all kinds of nieces and nephews running around. Hint, they're not nieces and nephews. But you don't call him on the carpet because he is the Pope. And many others, down, and even the current crisis that they're still dealing with, much of that has to do with some of their requirements. So just kind of keep that in mind. If I'm talking to a group of, and I'm not here, obviously, but if I was speaking to a group of college students, because that question is going to come up, I guarantee it. In one form or another, it will come up. There'll be somebody that will bring that up or want to talk to us about it in private. You have to deal with those kind of sensitively, Because, you know, have you ever thought about a longing to have a family? They say, well, yeah, you don't have this gift. You know, do you think about you think about sex? Yeah, you don't have that gift. Don't try to live some. You understand what I'm saying? I don't need to belabor the point. The disciples were concerned not with the celibacy part. They were concerned with marriage being permanent. And so that was what their concern was. Questions or comments? Bright bunch of people, I know it.
Was divorce common?
Was divorce common? Yes. I mean, it was regularly noticed. We can look at a passage like this and we can think that, well, the woman is being victimized. Yes and no. Yes, she is. In Jewish culture, she really could not initiate a divorce. In Greek culture, that women could. Greco-Roman culture, they could. But the woman is being protected with the writ of divorce. That's important. And what do I mean by protected? Well, there wasn't a lot of occupations or methods of getting or survival in the ancient world for women that were unattached. They did not have their father or a husband. They were in dire straits. That's why you find that the widows and orphans have a very special place in God's heart. A very special place because they're vulnerable. They can be taken advantage of. And it was the same way in the ancient world. And so that writ of divorce freed her. Freed her. Maybe not morally, because we've got this clause that follows back up in there where it says, and I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. So you drop out the exception clause and you have, you know, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. But the man is initiating this. And then, of course, and a questionable passage because it's not in the oldest manuscripts. And whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. That second part is absent in a lot of the, you may not, it, maybe in some of your translations it doesn't even appear. And that the reason why is it appears in later manuscripts, but not the oldest, what's considered the most reliable. That can be debated. But anyway, what it's doing is freeing her up. Now, that clause, that last part, could be a reference to, is the divorce took place because of sexual immorality. And then whoever would come next to this woman, he would be committing adultery.
What if it was the man that committed the sexual immorality?
Well,
and he divorced his wife so he could marry somebody else.
Yes, well, that's what Jesus is pointing to. No, not for any reason. There's one reason, there's one activity, one action that breaks the marital bond. And that is unfaithfulness. It doesn't mean you have to divorce, but it means that divorce is indeed permissible. Now, before we move on from this, let's be a little bit, at least on the humble, take a humble posture and realize we're not talking about every conceivable kind of scenario here. We need to be aware of that. Because there are conceivable scenarios, especially probably in the ancient world, but in our world too, our day, that are not necessarily falling easily within what's being said here. This is a response to one question. Okay? Not a response to every question. For example, and I could just tell you what I would do in a situation like I'm going to paint a picture here. If a woman came to me and her husband was forcing her to do something illegal, or he was endangering her life, I may not immediately go to the issue of divorce, but I would strongly recommend that she gets in a position where she can protect herself, which means away from him. I would not, in good conscience, send her back into a dangerous home. And see, that's a different scenario entirely. Understand, that is not being dealt with here. There's other passages. What we find in 1 Corinthians 7, Jesus already has dealt with this earlier in the Sermon on the Mount. And then, of course, Luke and also Mark deal with it as well. Make sense? Cautiously make sense? Okay. Just, you know, sometimes we get into a certain kind of situations where the situation may not be easily understood in the context that we're thinking of it. Okay? And not to go too far with it, and because I don't have time, and if I'm going to get through the rest of the passage dealing with this, but when you move into the qualifications for a pastor and for a deacon, we come at that with preconceived ideas. When you begin looking at it, if you try to kind of step back and just look at what the text itself says, it's quite interesting that you might draw some various conclusions. For example, when it says that to be the husband of one wife, that is an English rendering of the Greek text. What the Greek text says, a one-woman man. That's what it literally says. Now, to bring that over into English, it is usually translated the husband of one wife. Now, the question we have to ask and do some of our research, and there's plentiful tools available now to everybody. If you've even got a smartphone, you can find a ton of information free of charge that will give you some very important background information that will be helpful. For example, a man living in the Greco-Roman culture, a Gentile, not a Jew, a Gentile. Paul is writing to Timothy, and later he writes to Titus. They are they have Jews in the congregation they're serving, but there are also a lot of Gentiles. A Gentile man, not everyone, but it was customary, they would have a wife through whom legitimate heirs would be born. So he would have a legitimate wife. He would also have a mistress who may also have children or his children, and she might be a long-term mistress or a short-term one. He also would practice, he would also indulge in with prostitutes. You see a problem here. That's the Greco-Roman world. So what Paul is talking about, a one woman man. If you read the passage, you will not find divorce anywhere in there. We import that in there. Now, I'm not, you've got to do a lot more work, honestly, and we've got to deal with that passage adequately and accurately. But Paul is not talking about that. What he's talking about is what these Greek and Roman men were many times doing. You cannot have a man in leadership in the church who has a wife, a mistress, and goes to prostitutes. You can't do that. He is not fit. He's not qualified. And every one of you would say, what? Amen to that? Yeah. Well, sure you would. So we need to be a little more, I think a little more humble in some of our preconceived. When I was much younger, I had it much more clearly figured out. Okay? As time goes on, I start realizing, well, some of my preconceived notions were just that. Things that I had imported to the text and not what was actually in the text. And we all have a tendency to do that. We do. of importing stuff into it instead of just seeing what the text actually says. And I think I've belabored that enough. And to be safe, I'm moving on. Okay? All right, we move on a little bit further in verse 13. The little children were brought to him that he might put his hands on them and pray, and the disciples rebuked them. And Jesus said to them, "Let the little children come to me, and do not forbid them, for such is the kingdom of heaven." And he laid his hands on them and departed from there. The King James Version, I always struggled with it. Suffer the little children to come unto me. That word suffer, I knew what suffering was. I just didn't know, figure out how that was going to work there. But that's just an old archaic word that has changed meaning significantly over the years. He's tired. Children were not treated or thought of like in our culture. Our culture, in many ways, is led by children. And they have a lot of buying power, and they have a lot of persuading buying power. You know, if you have small children, you don't usually go to McDonald's for the food. It's for the Happy Meal and the junky little toy that's inside of it. Or the French fries. Sometimes French fries taste pretty good, but yeah, that's a different thing. And you know, you can see that. If you watch commercials on television from time to time, especially those that are targeting children, you can kind of understand that there's a lot of persuading power that children might have. And when you check out at the whatever store, you know children are targeted there, and people who like tabloids, because there it is. You know, if you have a little feller that wants a candy bar and he starts throwing a fit, you'll probably get the candy bar just to shut him up. You don't want to deal with it. That may sound kind of harsh, but it's true, is it not? Well, in a lot of families, that is true. It is true. And that's why they're there. That's why they're there. It wasn't this culture. This culture, children not only were not to be seen or not to be heard. They were just kind of out there, they weren't looked upon. Yeah, parents love their children. I don't mean that, but they didn't take center stage. You know, we get together at a meal. First thing, who eats first? Who gets the plate first? Didn't do that in the ancient world. The men ate, the women ate, then the children ate. You know, little Jimmy Dickens, take an old cold tater and wait. You know, if you don't know what that is, YouTube it. That's the way the culture was. Now, I want you to understand that children weren't looked upon as having, you know, a lot of rights either. So I want you to picture all of that. And here's Jesus. Undoubtedly, he's tired. They traveled from Galilee down to the other side of the Jordan, where this is going on, people all around, and then they start bringing their children to Jesus. The disciples say, "Don't bring those kids here. He didn't have time to mess with them," or whatever they said. And Jesus rebukes his disciples for rebuking the parents bringing the children. He wanted them to come. He wanted them to come. And he laid his hands on them. The laying on of the hands is simply a symbol of blessing. People wanted their children blessed. And they wanted Jesus to do the blessing. And they were bringing the children to him. We don't know how many children. We don't know how deep the line was. We know nothing about those things. But Jesus rebuked his disciples for rebuking the children. Okay? Now we move on into verse 16. Now behold, one came to him, "Good teacher, what good thing shall I do that I may have eternal life?" A very good question. Except it is, biblically speaking, a wrong phrased question. What good thing must I do in order to inherit or receive eternal life? What is it that I need to do? Jesus' response to him is somewhat surprising. He first, in almost a rebuke, says, and he said to him, "Why do you call me good? No one is good but one, that is God." You're asking me about something that's good. Why are you doing that? Now, it's kind of a subtle implication of Jesus' claim to deity, to be God. Because he points out, there's only one good, and that's God. And then he proceeds to answer the question. In somewhat of a surprising way, he says, "But if you want to enter into life, keep the commandments." When he says commandments, this man knows exactly what Jesus is referring to. Is he talking about don't eat shellfish? Don't eat catfish? Stay away from the pork? Is that what he's thinking about? No, he understands what Jesus would mean. He's talking about the moral law. You know what the moral law is as well. We call it the Ten Commandments. And his response, his question to Jesus is, well, which ones? Jesus throws at him six of the ten. But the six that he sends, or the six that he cites, are the ones that are related for our horizontal human to human relationship. You see, there, if when we look at the Ten Commandments, and I think I've shown you this before, if not, or I have, tolerate it again if you would please. You have the vertical commandments between us and God. And you also have the horizontal commandments. And that's us and others. There's six of these, four of these. Okay? And that's a kind of a good way to think about it. Because what Jesus, what he's doing is he's focusing on the horizontal commandments. Okay, let's look at those. And Jesus said, "You shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, honor your father and your mother, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself," which is kind of a summary of those. Okay? The young man's response is, "All these I have kept from my youth. What do I still lack?" So he's thinking, this is too easy. Well, do you think he has kept these six commandments perfectly? Now, he may think he has. Compared to my brother, I've done a real good job. I never sassed mom back. I thought about it, but I didn't do it. So he's thinking about just simply the externals. That's what most of us think. We think about the externals. As long as I don't actually do this, I'm okay. Now, in the Sermon on the Mount that we dealt with months ago, Jesus pointed out, no, it's not the mere act, it's the desire that you have prior to the act that is also sinful. You see. So, well, he hasn't physically murdered anyone, he hasn't physically committed adultery, he hasn't physically stolen anything, he hasn't lied about anyone, he's not been a bearer of false witness, he's honored his father and his mother, at least according to his standards. So he feels pretty good about himself. Many of us do. The Pharisees felt very good about themselves because not only did they feel they were keeping the commandments, they thought they were doing a superb job of keeping the commandments. And Jesus scolded them with the strongest language that he scolded anybody because of that false belief that they really were keeping the commandments. They weren't. It looked like they were. You and I would think they were, but Jesus goes not simply to the action, he goes to the heart. It's the heart that's the problem. That's what Jeremiah warns us of. If you read in Jeremiah 17, verse 9, deceitful above all else and desperately sick. Who could know it? That's an indictment. That we have something fundamentally wrong with us. Deep down, spiritually wrong with us. And that is the result of the fall. Anytime we think that we're just pretty good folk, what we end up doing is comparing ourselves with other people. And we think somehow God is going to grade on a curve. You know, I'm higher on the curve than these other people are, so I'm, you know, I'm not doing those kind of things. I'm not the drug addict. I'm not a person who's embezzling. I'm not a person who's you know, whatever. I'm not that. So I must be better, right? I'm okay. But see, the thing that is, that's not the standard. It's much deeper than that. And it's the heart that's the problem. And this young man doesn't know that. Jesus knows it. How do I know that Jesus knows it? Because what he does next. You see, he's dealt with these superficially. But then he goes to these. How does he go to these? Does he quote those four? No, he didn't quote them. But he points them out. Verse 21. And Jesus said to him, if you want to be perfect, if you want to be complete, this is what you need to do. Go and sell all that you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come and follow me. You know Jesus was not a televangelist, right? He doesn't say, give me all your money, support my... No, Jesus says, give it to the poor and you follow me. But when the young man heard that saying, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. Why do I think that now Jesus is dealing with these? He showed the young man who his God is. It's not God. It's not merely that he had things. His things had him. That's how you see that he shifted to those... That's not my car, is it? I slapped my britches there, so I may have done that. I had a class with one of my professors was a man named Dr. Hugh Womble. Womble was a church history professor, and Womble was brilliant. When I say this, he would come in with his notes in a folder. He'd set them down, and then he would lecture. He never looked at them. We thought he had a photographic memory. Because someone in one class asked him, what was Martin Luther's birthday? He popped it out just like that. Well, anyway. So Dr. Womble was just phenomenal. He would actually, when the bell would ring, he'd begin his lecture. And when the bell would ring again, he would conclude it. Even mid-sentence, he would just stop. He didn't finish a thought. He's there. And the next class, I saw it myself. I wouldn't believe it. Next class, he'd begin in the middle of the sentence and finish it. That's how brilliant he was. A good friend of mine, Stephen Fugit, was in Dr. Womble's class. And when we get to seminary, you got to realize we dump the backpacks. That's college. We got briefcases now. Okay? We have our own peer pressure. So anyway, Stephen had one of those little... micro recorders, so he would record some of the classes so he could make sure he get the notes down. And it was in his briefcase, and there in Dr. Womble's class, you could hear people started looking around, you know, trying to figure out what it was. Steve was doing the same thing, looking around, and then it dawned on him. He looked down, and he popped open the briefcase. Sure enough, his tape recorder was playing. He was playing someone else's lecture. And then, red-faced, he said to Dr. Womble, said, I'm sorry. And Dr. Wilton said, yes, you are. Everybody erupted and whatnot. Anyway, it's funny. Why was I telling you about Womble? I don't know. Anyway, though, the young man, he understands, and Jesus points it out quite clearly, that his problem is much deeper than he thought. I know you might be somewhat distressed that Jesus didn't say you need to pray the sinner's prayer. You need to ask for forgiveness. But in this particular case, he pointed out quite clearly the problem. We don't know. We're told in, I think, Mark's gospel that Jesus looked on him and loved him. But he still said the same thing. And what Jesus did do, don't miss this, Jesus let him walk away. He didn't chase after him, say, wait a minute, come back, and maybe we can talk about this more. He let him walk away. Because the young man had, not only had great possessions, he was held captive by his possessions. So, Jesus, it was clear. Then, verse 23, then Jesus said to his disciples, assuredly I say to you that it is hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. And again I say to you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. Now I'm going to pause right there before going any further. There was a interpretation that I've heard in many different regions of the country that's false. The interpretation of that is, well, in the gates of Jerusalem, and there's a wall there, that after the gates are shut, a camel could not get through. You'd have to unpack the camel and had to get down and crawl kind of on his knees, and you could get it to go through that much smaller entrance. That's not true. That's not true. Take it for what it says. There wasn't a little gate called the needle's eye. That was the point. You know how I know that? Because when you go to Luke's gospel, one of the indications that Luke was indeed a physician, other than Jesus, and then Paul calls him the blood physician, is that the needle he uses, when he uses the word needle, it's the one you use to sew up a cut, to suture a cut. Closed. He's talking about a needle. Now, this should be somewhat, and we'll get to that in a moment, because you see how the disciples take this. They're not saying, oh yeah, he just got to humble himself. And no, they don't do that. They're shocked. Matter of fact, it says it that when his disciples heard it, they were greatly astonished, saying, who then can be saved? So what's the issue? Well, the thought was, or the understanding was, if God likes you, God will place His favor on you, and you will prosper. Kind of like the prosperity preachers you hear today. You know, if you give $10, God will give you $100 back. You know, if you give the $10 to me, He will give you $100 back. That kind of stuff, the prosperity idea. But they're looking at it was not gotten by giving necessarily, but it was by just if you had a lot, if you were wealthy, they thought that was indication that God is pleased with you. That God was pleased. That was the evidence of it. God's pleased because He's blessed you with wealth. So the disciples, when they heard this, they are not simply astonished, they're greatly astonished. Wait a minute. Isn't that the indication of God's blessing on a person? That they're wealthy? And you're saying that it's impossible for them to be saved? And then he follows up by saying, well, then Peter answered and said to him, verse 26, but Jesus looked at them and said to them, with men, this is impossible, but with God, all things are possible. No, it's not hopeless. There have been, and there probably still are, a lot of wealthy people that have honored God with, with their lives and with their wealth. So it's not saying that they can't be saved. But there's a problem. The problem is right here. Is right here. Now, I want to follow this up, though, because we sometimes zero in and we get just one side of the coin. But you got to understand. I think it was Andrew Carnegie that was asked, how much money is enough? He said, $1 more than you have. Which indicates something. But you need to understand, the poor can be just as greedy as the rich. They can still have just the same problem here. How do I know? Just watch it. Just watch people when the lottery gets up. $10 million. Watch people. People who don't have the money are trying to win. Because they have the same issue there. It's the problem is the heart problem. And by the way, do you know what the lottery is? It's a tax on people who are poor in math. You ain't going to win. You're not. The house always wins. You need to know that. Oh, yeah, but... Well, so you won $5 once. Of course, you spent $100 trying to win again. You know, it's a racket. And everybody should know that. But it is a tax on people who are really poor at math. You're more likely to get struck by lightning 7 times than you are to win. Now, just having said, the problem that we see in the rich young ruler is not simply relegated to the rich young ruler. It's the heart of all of us. That's the problem. Okay. Then Peter answered and said to him, see, we have left all to follow you. Therefore, what shall we have? You just ask this man to do that very thing. We've done that. And Jesus' response, so Jesus said to them, assuredly I say to you, that in the regeneration, when the Son of Man sits on his throne of his glory, you who have followed me will also sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And everyone who has left house or brother or sister or father or mother or wife or children or lands for my name's sake shall receive a hundredfold and inherit eternal life. But many who are first will be last. And the last, first. So he throws that in at the very end of his discourse there. Yeah, you may have given it up here, but you're going to get far more there. The difficulty that we have is understanding the far more. It's deferred, but it's still coming. When the Bible talks about we have an inheritance, you don't possess it now. But you do possess it now. You just don't have it in your hands now, but it's coming. I've got years ago, I bought some books. Well, actually, they were kind of little manuals done by Focus on the Family. It's called, it helped in family time. It was object lessons you did with your kids to teach them, eternal kinds of lessons. One was, and I never did do this, but I have a tendency I'd like to have, but I just didn't get around to it. But the fellow that wrote it talked about what he had done with his boys. He had a couple of boys, and he went and got a 5-gallon bucket and brought it in and filled it half full of water, and the remainder he put just a bag of ice in it. And then he told his boys, we're going to have a contest. The contest is, I'm going to take he had a little bag of marbles. I'm going to take these marbles and he poured them into this concoction, this icy water. And he told them, said, I will give you $5 for every marble you can bring out with your toes. And then sit back and watch. Now they're little boys, so you know they're going for it. So they plunge their foot down in there, and they it's cold, it's hurting, and they try to fish out those marbles. Of course, the marbles are wet and slick, and most people don't have a lot of dexterity in their toes anyway, and it wasn't working too well. But they just kept after it. Finally, he stopped them because, you know, they're turning blue. It's time to stop them. And then he just asked them a question. Why did you do that? Why would you put your foot down and up to your knee, pretty much, into that icy cold water to try to bring up a marble? Their answer was, because of the $5 we would get if we did it. So, he used that to illustrate that things, we may suffer here in this world, but we can suffer in a way that has hope because of what's coming. Far more rewarding than $5. Far better than that. But we're going to have to wait to get it. And, for little guys, that clicked in their heads. They understood. So Jesus points out, yes, you're going to receive this, but not upon this earth at this time. You're going to sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel, but not yet. And then in verse 30, he concludes with the words, another expression of a great reversal. Many who are first will be last, and the last first. Now that can be understood in a variety of ways. And I'm going to conclude with another illustration of this. This one is from Ruth Bell Graham, Billy Graham's wife. She was asked to speak at the funeral of a woman that had been praying for Billy Graham and the ministry of the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association for much of her latter years. She prayed all the time for that ministry, even when it was just first starting. And among the things that Mrs. Graham said was, during that funeral service, she pointed down to the casket and said, "The reason for Billy's success is right here. Because of her prayers." To piggyback a little bit on C.S. Lewis, who I love to do, he pointed out there's going to be three amazing things in heaven. And of course you're wondering where's he going to go with this. He said the three amazing things in heaven are going to be, and he says, first, the people who are not there that you expected to be in heaven. Secondly, the second surprise will be people who are there that you didn't think would be there. And he said, and the greatest surprise of all is that you are there. He's got a point. Okay, next time we will pick up with chapter 20. We're moving toward the cross because we're down in Judea now. And we're going to be dealing with you're going to see the intensity of what's taking place in Jesus' ministry to be ratcheted up significantly, especially when we hit chapter 23. So we're moving into that. All right, you're free to go. Thank you.